If you like Area 45, you're going to enjoy the Hoover Institution's other podcasts, Uncommon Knowledge, The Classicist with Victor Davis Hanson, and The Libertarian with Richard Epstein. Subscribe now to the Hoover Podcast at hoover.org/podcasts. That's hoover.org/podcasts. Hoover Podcast, ideas defining a free society. Hello, it's Wednesday, September the 26th, and welcome to Area 45, a Hoover Institution podcast examining the policy avenues available to the 45th President of the United States. I'm Bill Whalen, the Hoover Institution's Virginia Hobbs Carpenter Fellow in Journalism and a Research Fellow. Joining me today in studio here on the campus of Stanford University is Michael Oslin. He is the Hoover Institution's inaugural Williams Griffiths Fellow in Contemporary Asia, specializing in global risk analysis, U.S. security and foreign policy strategy, and security and political relations in Asia. And I'm waiting for him to update his Stanford biography because he is a Stanford dad. Congratulations.
Thank you very much.
What is it like to have a son enrolled at Stanford? Do you have a tattoo on your forehead? Do you wear a ball cap around? How do you show it off?
I think we're just getting our heads around having a son in college, let alone Stanford. But yeah, I've got to trade in some of my Hoover stuff for Stanford dad sweatshirt. So
right, and you're Chicagoans. How did you let him out of Chicago? Why is he not going to Northwestern?
Well, that's a good point. He grew up in D.C.
So
he did not want to be on the East Coast, and this gets you as far as you can. Except of course, his parents are out here too for a while. So.
So great. So you guys are palling around every weekend.
We hope to.
Right.
We hope to.
So how long before they can ditch the parents?
As soon as he possibly can.
So let's talk today about something that is not related to Brett Kavanaugh. Believe it or not, there is non-Kavanaugh news, and it happened in New York this week, and that is President Trump going to the UN General Assembly and giving a speech in which he took aim at a couple of nations, one being Iran, but also one being China. And Michael, here's what he said, quote, "I have great respect and affection for my friend President Xi Jinping, but I have made clear that our trade imbalance is just not acceptable. China's market distortions and the way they deal cannot be tolerated." Now, timing is everything, and as the president is giving this speech, the U.S. rolls out another $200 billion worth of tariffs against Chinese goods, to which Beijing replies with $60 billion worth of tariffs of its own against U.S. goods. The total value of goods between the two countries now subject to tariffs is at about $360 billion. Michael, this raises a question as to who's winning this right now. And let's start this by talking about a column that Tom Friedman has today in the New York Times. By the face you're making, I can see you're not a fan of Tom Friedman. The column, though, for our listeners who haven't seen it, it's out today, Wednesday the 26th. The title is Trump to China, I Own You, Guess Again. And the subhead, the Chinese are catching up to us in ways, and the U.S. in many ways that President Trump does not understand. You read that column. What do you think?
Yeah, I mean, it's not a question of being a fan of Tom Friedman or not, as much as I think a lot of the debate over what's going on both in China, mm-hmm. between China and the U.S. and the sort of macro questions of the U.S. is just it's not often based on a deep understanding of mm-hmm. of history and what how things have evolved in the past. Give you an example. In 1985, we were pretty close to the height, or we were certainly entering the highest pitch of anti-Japanese fervor in this country. We had watched the Japanese hollow out our steel industry, mm-hmm. hollow out our consumer electronics industry.
Right.
The automobile industry was making leaps and bounds. There were books coming out claiming that there was the one with the title, The Coming War with Japan. The Japanese were about to buy Rockefeller Center. We basically thought it was over for the United States.
Right.
In 1985, the U.S. GDP was 4.3 trillion dollars. $4.3 trillion dollars was U.S. GDP. And on a superficial level, everyone was right. The Japanese did hollow out our consumer electronics and steel and auto industries. They did buy up lots of U.S. property and so on and so forth.
Right.
Well, fast forward to today, and in 2017, when the U.S. did not get back its consumer electronics, did not get back steel, did not get back autos, the U.S. economy is $19.4 trillion. So I don't quite get exactly what the argument is. Mm-hmm. The fact that China, in Friedman's column, he mentions, China now has 9 of the 20 largest corporations on earth.
Right.
Versus whatever, 10 years ago when they had none, or 20 years ago when they had none. What's the point? Mm-hmm. I don't quite get what he's saying. China has 1.3 billion people. He talks about their search engines, and he talks about their online shopping. What he doesn't talk about is what those who really are informed about the issue and think about it very carefully talk about, which is the China net, which is that China's internet basically is about China and only about China. It doesn't interact with the rest of the world in the ways ours does, and that's because of central government control and restrictions. So if you're talking about this internet, what exactly are you talking about? The fact that they have a big one? Well, they got a population four times the size of us.
Right.
Is it that they're going to supplant our internet? Well, again, now let's look back at the Japanese example. So I just think that there's such hyperbolic commentary about what's going on with China, and very little of it talks about the problems that China has and the
right.
problems it faces. And Friedman, in fact, starts off this column of his by talking about China's rich are rich in ways Americans can't even imagine.
Right. He says it's gone from near peer-to-peer status. The column, Michael,
which is not true, by the way.
Right. Oh,
which is not true.
Okay.
First of all, Tom Friedman, more than anyone else, knows how rich Americans can be and hanging out in the Hamptons and the like, and we have an incredibly flourishing
right.
class of extremely wealthy. But what he doesn't talk about are the hundreds of millions in China who are still in dire poverty. And he doesn't talk about the failures of the state, and he doesn't talk about social dissatisfaction, and he doesn't talk about the fact that that Xi Jinping is clamping down so severely on civil society in China
right.
that some wonder if it's even going to survive. So,
right. So like most Friedman columns, Michael, he uses it to get into the Friedman agenda, which is invariably three things. Number one, more immigration in the United States.
Right.
Number two, strengthen international ties. And number three, what he calls doubling down on American values, which I read as kind of not so thinly hint that we need to get rid of Donald Trump. That's the Friedman agenda in a nutshell. But you've looked at this and you've come to the conclusions, however much criticized, that the tariff war is at home, it's actually doing damage to China's economy.
Well, we know that. And in fact, we've had a lot of reports coming out of China and a piece, in fact, just written by Neil Ferguson, one of our fellows here at Hoover, on the fact that the Chinese, and I can attest to what Neil wrote, having talked to people myself from China, they don't really know what to do mm-hmm. in response to the
right.
tariff. Now, I'm not in favor of trade wars, by the way. Let me make that straight. Let me be clear.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not in favor of trade wars. On the other hand, China's unfair trade practices should have been addressed long ago. Here's the problem, Bill, is that we turned a blind eye to this for so many years and under so many different presidents that finally, when we decide to get serious about it, just as the Democrats have been very serious about Chinese unfair trading practices, it looks like World War III, because suddenly you've got to take severe steps when you could have corrected this a long time ago. So as usual, we're hoist by our own petard by not
right.
doing anything early. But that said, because of the massive trade imbalance of about $300 billion between the U.S. and China, you know, total trade is over $500 billion, and there's about a $300 billion trade imbalance, the simple fact is they cannot put tariffs on as many goods of ours as we can put on theirs.
Mm-hmm.
They need our market more than we need theirs. We can, though it would be disruptive, it would be painful, it would be expensive in some cases, we can find other sources of materials. It is driving up costs for American companies. There's no question about it.
Mm-hmm.
But the Chinese face a much larger problem in that if we really do severely cut back their access to this market, where do they go?
Right.
We are the richest market, most developed market in the world, and the Europeans are not a solution for them. So the Chinese are very worried about this, but they're also worried in a way that we should recognize, is that politically, they've never had anyone stand up to them and do this. Now, back in the 90s, again, to bring up Japan, we had trade wars with Japan, and we threatened trade wars with Japan to deal with a much smaller trade imbalance. And we basically forced the Japanese into a bunch of different trade dialogues that ultimately resulted in the Japanese, you know, putting on certain caps and curbs on their own exports into the United States, anti-dumping and stuff like that. I think that the Trump administration essentially wants to do the same thing, and the Chinese themselves have floated that. In fact, when this all started up a few months ago, the Chinese were among the first to float the idea of voluntary caps. And that's exactly what the Japanese did.
Mm-hmm.
So at the end of the day, just like the Japanese, who in the 1980s and early 90s, don't forget, we thought were the unstoppable economic force, they knew they couldn't win a trade war with us, and I think the Chinese understand that as well. Now, that doesn't mean it's a good thing, and it doesn't mean that it won't be messy on both sides, because it will be. But the simple fact that China has a bunch of gigantic internet companies doesn't mean that either they can ignore everything that's going on in the world around them, or that they simply are hostage to anything we do. It is going to be a balance and a negotiation between the two sides.
Sounds like Mr. Friedman got distracted by the big shiny objects. Two stats I'd like for you to expand upon here. Number one, the Chinese stock market's at a 4-year low.
Yeah.
And secondly, 6.7% GDP growth.
Mm-hmm.
What happens to GDP growth in China, and why is the market at a 4-year low? Markets dip for all kinds of reasons, technical corrections, lack of consumer confidence. Why is China's market suffering?
Well, let's start with the GDP. First of all, that's the official number.
Right.
And I know a great number of economists who are much better with numbers than I am, who don't believe that it's that high.
Where do they ballpark it?
Everyone has their own different take on it. I think the average of folks would probably come out around 4%, mm-hmm. but there are those who believe that China is in essentially secular stagnation, meaning it's at 1-2% at best. It's not that the Chinese government is lying. I think it's more the case that the Chinese government itself probably doesn't know, because it's not getting accurate figures. It's not getting accurate numbers. The state-owned enterprise sector is a huge drag on this economy. What you see is that every year, the government, well, they used to set an exact numerical number to say we're going to get 7% growth or 6.8% growth. Right. Now they give a range. But miraculously, it always hits that range, just as it always used to hit that exact number. And so I think any you know, economist worth their salt would be very skeptical about this. And there are other ways of trying to figure out exactly what's going on, energy usage and things like that. But for the most part, I don't know of any economist who really believes that it's at 6.7%. But even if it is, the larger trend is that the macro picture has been steadily slowing. Now, that's partly to be expected. It's a maturing economy. It has grown dramatically over the past two decades or so. It is natural for it to slow down. And on the other hand, there is enormous inefficiency in this market, the state-owned economic sector or state-owned enterprise sector that I just mentioned. Massive malinvestment, a huge debt problem, maybe upwards of $20 trillion worth. There are major drags on this economy that is causing that macro picture to slow and to continue to slow, in conjunction with the fact that it's a maturing economy and it's an aging society. Mm-hmm. That, in turn, has an effect on the stock market. And the stock market bubble really popped in 2015. It lost about a third of its value. It then dropped again when they reopened it, and there's been massive capital flight on the order of over $1.5 trillion worth of capital leaving China, because people don't have confidence in the future of this system. They want to get their money out of China and offshore to somewhere else like the United States, where you can buy property, or other places. And so the stock market is low in part because there's very good reason to have concerns about where this economy goes in the future.
If Donald Trump did not have his current day job, if he were still fiddling around in real estate in Manhattan, would he be sniffing around the Waldorf Astoria at this point, the storied hotel in New York?
Yeah, in fact, I think the Chinese are selling the Four Seasons in Jackson Hole. They've already announced that. So the consortium, there is a major a real estate company that's beginning to unwind some of its positions. Yeah, it's the same thing again. Same thing that happened to the Japanese. You know, when the Japanese bought Rockefeller Center, everybody said, that's it. You know, the crown jewel symbol of American capitalism is gone, Pebble Beach. Mm-hmm. And the Japanese wound up selling them in less than a decade and for massive losses.
Right.
The Chinese in general have been much more strategic, much smarter about their buying spree, their acquisition spree, in part because they saw what happened to the Japanese. They saw that the Japanese bought baubles. Mm-hmm. And that they were not good investments. Now, even so, the Chinese have overinvested, and they're beginning to unwind. The Anbang Insurance Company, for example, one of the large real estate owners in the United States, including I'm pretty sure Waldorf Astoria. I'm just blanking for a second on it, but anyway, they're beginning to unwind those positions. So, will we see it probably continuing? Some of that is the natural ebb and flow of a real estate market. I think you have to look at some of the more significant purchases Chinese have made. For example, of things like Smithfield Farms, the largest pork producer in the country. Mm-hmm. Large, more industrial-oriented concerns like that which in part they wanted so that they didn't, they themselves didn't have to worry as much about market, you know, global market prices and forces, and instead would have more assurance of access to the types of goods and services that they wanted. Now, did they begin unwinding more of those? And that's something that, honestly, I don't think we do a very good job looking at. There are some who do, you know, looking at Chinese outbound investment and then retrenchment. I think we have to get better at it. You know, when the Japanese were forced to sell some of those purchases of theirs, it made huge headlines. Mm-hmm. I don't see it making as much headlines with China, but again, they were smarter in what they bought. They didn't, right. you know, try to buy. I mean, they did. They did buy the Waldorf Astoria, but it's worth paying a much closer eye to see, you know, are these companies so overleveraged that the state is cracking down on them, which is in some cases, they simply don't trust management, which is happening in other cases, mm-hmm. or that these are just not economic good bets, which may be some of the third set of cases.
I've heard you utter this phrase before. You say countries around the world have woken up to the dark side of doing business with China.
Yeah.
What is the dark side of doing business with China?
Well, there's a couple angles to it. I think that the two most prominent, one we face and one we don't face. The one we face is basically Chinese intimidation of American companies to accept Chinese interpretations of the world. And by that, I mean that American companies can no longer list Taiwan on their websites. They can't list Hong Kong on their websites. They can't list Tibet on their websites.
Let's drill down for a moment, Michael, and talk yeah. about the Chinese relationship with Apple.
Yeah.
How does that work?
Well, all American tech companies have faced real problems mm-hmm. in getting into the Chinese market. And when they have, of course, they have to play by local rules.
Right.
That's natural. You know, foreign companies here have to play by local rules.
Right.
The problem, of course, is that a lot of China's local rules cut against corporate independence, and they cut against free flow of information.
Right.
In the case of tech companies, it's a particular issue because that's the commodity that they trade in, which is mm-hmm. why there's such uproar about Google or Facebook trying to get back into the country. If in order to do so, you must build in censorship processes into, you know, into what you're doing, which is what has been floated most recently about Google.
Right.
In the case of Apple, it is they had to get a Chinese partner mm-hmm. in order to offer a cloud service.
Right.
That Chinese partner was a business that was actually owned by one of the provincial governments. Apple stated that information was safe, that they held the keys to the encryption, that mm-hmm. It was physically separated. There's a lot of questions about the degree to which you can be safe if you have a Chinese partner. What exactly is the sharing? What are the back doors? There are all sorts of concerns that the tech companies are rushing in because they see the massive growth of this market. They feel they're behind precisely because of those big corporations that we mentioned before.
Right.
And they want to get in. And after a period of concern over what that would mean for their business models, they seem, at least some in the case of Google mm-hmm. and Apple, seem to be shedding that concern. Now, they will say, you don't understand how we do business, and we are protecting, or at least Apple will say, we're protecting this information. There are others who dispute that. In the case of Google, it's a little harder because what was leaked from Google made very clear that they were building in search engines with censorship elements to it right off the bat, and
right.
that Chinese consumers who were using these products would have to register with their cell phones,
right.
and this information would be shared with Chinese partners. So, you know, what type of protection do you have when you basically have all the information you need? And that's the funny part too, Bill, is that the Chinese, in this great new competition over artificial intelligence and the like, the Chinese will say, we are the kings of data. We have more data than anyone else, and therefore, at the end of the day, we're going to be better at artificial intelligence because we're going to have more data to make this machine learning and deep learning and algorithmic learning better. And they're not wrong with that. But the reason they have more data is that there are very few firewalls between the Chinese government and Chinese companies. The government can hoover up all of the information that it wants and put it to whatever use that it wants. So, for example, if you ride one of the Chinese share or the Chinese bike share bikes, right? Like Mobike or Ofo or things mm-hmm. like this. The data from your ride, where and who you are, when you got the bike, where you got the bike, where you took the bike, when you left the bike, all of that is stored in Beijing. That's the only place they have servers. They don't have overseas servers. It all goes to a central location in Beijing. So we have to think very carefully about what information privacy is in an age where mm-hmm. you use Chinese products or you allow your products into China and under their rules. And that is something that I would say we're pretty far behind the ball on.
Let's talk about the man running the government for a minute, Xi Jinping, president for life, in essence. He wants to have the job as long as he wants. It's there.
Yeah.
Donald Trump may envy him. He's not dogged. Xi is not dogged by impeachment. He's not meeting with FBI deputy directors who maybe are trying to wire up and get him kicked out of office. He's not getting into Twitter fights and so forth. But you've suggested there are cracks in the facade here, one of which is this president's fund is for surveillance cameras. Why is China a vast surveillance society?
Because it's an authoritarian society.
How many surveillance cameras are there in China?
Right now there's somewhere around 200 and some million. I forget the exact number, but they want to have about 650 million by 2022 or something like
that.
How
does this work? Is there just a surveillance camera on every telephone pole in China?
Pretty much. Mm-hmm. Pretty much. Not only that, the police are now outfitted with surveillance glasses. So they have smart glasses that can do the same thing that surveillance cameras do, except these are mobile because the police can be mobile. There was an experiment done with a BBC reporter who was located in 7 minutes in an interior Chinese city. Now, given that I think he was not of Chinese descent, it might be easier on the algorithms to pick out that face. Mm-hmm. But the Chinese say that they can identify almost anyone with 90%+ accuracy in the matter of minutes. That's 1.3 billion people. They're starting to sell this technology to not only other repressive regimes, but to democratic regimes. Britain's buying some of its facial recognition technology. China's the world's leader in facial recognition and voice recognition. They want to have a complete database of basically everyone in the country, and they're already using it. They already put up speeding ticket scoff laws on huge billboards when their cars pass by one of these cameras that captures them, records the face, matches it with a record, and then it goes up right there. Hey, this guy didn't pay his speeding tickets. They're doing it to shame family members for people who have been convicted of crimes or who have not paid back debt. So they're using it in ways that we would find utterly intrusive, but they're doing so because under Xi Jinping, the relative openness that has been that marked the I wouldn't say openness, opening is a better term, and modest liberalization that marked right. China in the 1990s and 2000s is gone. It's reversed. Under Xi Jinping, this is one-man rule, essentially. It's becoming more and more like one-man rule. It's not right. quite there yet, but it's getting close. This is a state that is reasserting the role of the party, so communist ideology. It's reasserting the role of the state in civil society. The sphere of freedom in China has shrunk dramatically in the 5 years that Xi Jinping has been in power, and it's going to continue. And by the way, the fact that he's president for life is probably the least important of his positions. In fact, he's General Secretary of the Communist Party. That's who really runs the country, mm-hmm. and he's that forever, as long as he wants. Now, it's very symbolic
right.
that they abolished the two-term limit on the presidency, but that just accords to the reality that this guy will make the choice whether he wants to stay or not, and he has reorganized government around himself. He runs what are called the small leading groups, which basically decide all of the major issues, and he's basically the head of all of them. So this is a man who, from the economy, even though he has a premier on security issues, even though he has a minister of defense, right. this is a guy who has put himself at the very center of decision-making, and he's going to stay there for a very long time.
Are you suggesting that you could end up one day with a Russia situation, Putin steps down as president, Medvedev becomes president, but Putin still calls the shots? Remember, Medvedev famously says to Obama, "I'll tell Vladimir."
Yeah, sure. I look, that's actually how it's happened in the mm-hmm. past. Deng Xiaoping stepped down from his position in the early 90s, but was the paramount leader until his death in 97, even though he held no official titles. And there are always reports about former Chinese leaders such as Hu Jintao. He was not a particularly powerful leader in office, but are his proteges in power, and is he wielding strings behind them, and the like. So this is something where it's built into a system that is not particularly how would you put it? I mean, obviously it's not democratic. It's not really responsive to changes in power until Xi Jinping, meaning you had these cliques and these interwoven networks where former leaders could maintain a decent amount of power, like Jiang Zemin, former leader. But with Xi, he's taking it to a different level. He's gone to a very different level, and this is a guy who is going to control every element and do it again, as I said.
When you talk repression in China, Michael, are you talking generational repression of young people who want more goods and liberties? Are you talking ethnic, or are you talking religious, or are you talking all of it?
It's ethnic and religious. Well, partly the ethnic and religious are tied together, like the Uyghurs, the Muslims in Xinjiang.
Explain that for me.
Yeah, so the Uyghurs are there's about 10 million of them. They are a minority, ethnic minority. They're Turkic. In essence, and they're out in Xinjiang, the far west. Mm-hmm. The Hui are the other great large Muslim group. They are about another 10 million. They're very well assimilated. Right. The Uyghurs are not, and Xinjiang has essentially become a repressive police state. Mm-hmm. Massive surveillance, massive paramilitary presence, police presence. Reports of forced DNA swabbing of citizens, and most recently reports that up to a potential million Uyghurs, 1 million Uyghurs, are incarcerated in re-education camps in Xinjiang. I mean, this is finally starting to get attention. So that's both religious, because of the terror, the acts that China calls terror acts of Uyghur radicals who are seeking independence or at least autonomy. As well as the fear, you know, the geopolitical fear that, you know, you can't let any province of China off on its own path, because that would lead to dominoes.
Right.
So there is much greater repression in Hong Kong. They're ethnically Chinese and they're the same religion, but much greater repression, squeezing Hong Kong's liberties. And of course, you know, increasing pressure on Taiwan, you know, whether you think Taiwan's independent or sovereign or not. So this is a government that is across the board more repressive. Your question about the young people, mm-hmm. you know, is interesting. We know that young Chinese are much more nationalistic. Mm-hmm. That's repeated in survey after survey. When they come abroad and they study at Western or other foreign universities, they are often very, very vocally pro-Chinese. They try mm-hmm. to shut down anti-Chinese discussions and if there are any anti-Chinese demonstrations, they counter them. I just read a statistic. I can't remember exactly, but it's about 40%. I can't remember. Don't quote me, but it's somewhere. Let's say 40% of Chinese who have studied overseas have come back, mm-hmm. and the government wants to increase that number. So they may be in part trying to select those who are more likely to come back to actually let them go, because you have to get exit visas. But of course, they want them over here to get the technical knowledge and then bring it back home. You know, do they want more freedom? There are definitely those who do. There's no question. And in fact, now they're in middle age. Those who came of age during the 1990s and particularly the 2000s were used to a freer internet in China. Mm-hmm. It was never fully free, but it was a lot freer than it was today. And they were used to much broader based discussions than you can have today. They were used to interacting more with foreign NGOs, non-governmental organizations, at least those in the cities, than they are today. So those are the people, I think, who are much more opposed to the diminution of civil society. Whether this younger group generation that doesn't know any different, you know, they don't know differently from this China, how will they be in 10 years? They may just think this is the way it ought to be, or we might find that Xi Jinping has overreached and the state has overreached, and instead of being the new normal, he was the aberration, and China will it will return to a path that might include, once again, more openness and more liberalization. Today, I don't think there's any way to bet, other than to say that every policy that Xi Jinping is putting into place is to try to prevent that.
So there's obviously a trade-off if you go back to China. You're a Chinese student at Stanford, USC, some American university for a few years, and you go back to your homeland, and there are trade-offs. You're not going to 20 cinema plexes, and you're not going to vast grocery stores and fancy department stores and so forth. A lot of material goods, but I suspect what does strike you is the freedom of thought and the freedom of expression. the unfettered internet. Michael, does the Chinese government push back? Does it, in essence, try to sell them? Does it try to brainwash, for lack of a better word, traveling students on the United States and say, well, you may think the internet is free over there, but you're being watched. Big Brother is watching the United States. Your phones are being monitored. Americans are spying on you. In other words, are they in any way trying to sell their own people on propaganda about the U.S.?
I'm sure they are. Right. I mean, I don't know. Clearly, when these young people live in China, they're getting fed that all the time.
Right.
You know, there's a dearth of information about the outside world. There is a, you know, a campaign by Xi Jinping to eradicate Western ideas and values that were maybe possibly slowly seeping into society.
Right.
To clamp down on religion again, you know, Christians and obviously Muslims and others, because those are loyalties that lie outside the state. So I think all of those messages were going into the young people. Now, you know, you don't, everyone's different. I'm sure there are some, if not many, young Chinese who come here and absolutely love what they see. This is exactly right. What they want. I'm sure there are others who come here and think it's horrible. And then there are others who probably think, you know, it's just about as bad or as good as anywhere else. And so, you know, how each of them deals with that information and uses it. All I think we can say with certainty is that we've had, so right now there are about 300,000 Chinese students studying in the United States.
300,000.
300,000. That's a third of all foreign students in the United States. And globally, there are 500 some thousand Chinese students, half a million Chinese students around the world. And that's been going on for a long time. And again, I just saw this figure. I can't remember. I think there's been, it's several millions, obviously, of Chinese students who have come here over the past couple decades. And again, a large proportion of them, not all of them, have gone back. And we haven't seen any change in China. Meaning the argument is that they're going to come here, they're going to see how great democracy is, and they're going to go back, and they're going to advocate for it at home. And they're going to start, you know, little magazines, they're going to start little protest groups and little interest groups, so on and so forth. I'm sure some of that is happening. But the fact is that China has not become more liberal in the decades that hundreds of thousands, millions of Chinese students have studied in America and then gone back to China. Mm-hmm. China's become more repressive. Now, obviously, that's because of Xi Jinping. But the point is that society has not, and civil society has not evolved to a point where it is either independent or it makes demands for this or it has found other allies within the elites for this. You know, Xi Jinping is setting the debate about the future of China. Mm-hmm. Some people say we live in China's world.
Right.
And I don't think that's right. But China is living in Xi Jinping's world. And he's the one determining all of this. So these students who, if they come back, committed, firm, small-D Democrats, as far as all of us can tell, they're making no difference.
Now, the Xi of 2013 was a reformer.
No, I don't think so.
Well, he unveils a reform agenda,
well, yeah.
Correct?
Yeah, he was like Gorbachev. Gorbachev right. didn't want to see the end of the Soviet Union. Gorbachev wanted a stronger Soviet Union and miscalculated right. how you get that.
But Xi talked reform. Right.
Well, not to summon the ghost of Bill Clinton, but it depends by, you know, what is the
what
meaning
is
of reform, right?
Okay, what does he propose in 2013? What is his great goal?
A whole host of measures to strengthen the economy.
Mm-hmm.
But reform doesn't mean liberalization necessarily, right. And it doesn't mean opening up.
Mm-hmm.
He talked about, yes, freeing up some capital, getting rid of some of the SOEs, state-owned enterprises. There was a whole host. I mean, there was a laundry list of things,
right.
Making it easier for people to move inside the country and get residency permits so you could work around the country. None of that's come to fruition.
Mm-hmm.
The state-owned enterprise sector is stronger than before. They've clamped down on capital. They have not freed up labor in any way. Basically, none of the reform policies have come into place except on the financial side. There has been some financial deregulation, some financial liberalization, but then again,
mm-hmm.
they felt in 2015 and the like it was going too far, so they've tried to clamp down on that. You know,
right.
you don't want all this capital leaving the country. Some deregulation in services. Again, you know, you now see the rise of giant Chinese companies going mm-hmm. in to fill those spaces. So again, was he a reformer? Okay, yes, he was a reformer, but he wasn't a liberalizer. We
right.
often conflate the two. We think reform means more choice and more freedom. No, reform mm-hmm. just means make the system work better and make
right.
us stronger. And from the very beginning, He has talked, Xi Jinping has talked about what he calls the China dream,
right,
rejuvenating the great Chinese nation, but doing so in ways that strengthen unique, what has always, you know, has been called for so long, socialism with Chinese characteristics. He has repeatedly emphasized that. This is not a guy saying we need more freedom. I mean, he does, but what he means by that is we need more, all of us to be on the page with the Communist Party, which brings us ultimate freedom, you know, in the long run.
What happens if he wakes up one morning and decides, you know, this just isn't right. This country deserves more freedom. I want to be a great liberator of people in China. Is he out of a job in 30 seconds? I mean, how could he actually affect change that way? Is the system just too great for one man to change it? Or does something dramatic have to happen within Chinese society to push along change?
It's a good question. I don't really think it's going to happen. And right. So, you know, the sole overriding goal of the Chinese Communist Party is to remain in power.
Right,
survival. Everything else revolves around that, and right. more freedom would mean the end of the Chinese Communist Party. And what's, you know, evidence A for that is the Soviet Union and Mikhail Gorbachev. Gorbachev right. is intensely studied in China, not because of his success, because of his failure
right.
in his destruction of the Soviet Union. So I don't think any of that would happen. Now, let's right. just say that it did. Then you're getting to the question of, is Xi Jinping fundamentally and permanently changing the nature of governance in China? I don't think he's there yet. Now, if he decides to stay beyond 2022 mm-hmm. and he packs the standing committee of the Politburo, which is the highest level committee of seven leaders with all of his own men, mm-hmm. and they're all men, and then decides to do an about turn, you know, it's possible, because he has, in many cases, he's gotten rid of so much opposition inside the country, often very hardline opposition, you know, real, you know, old-fashioned communist ideologues. But of course, he is, in his own way, I mean, not in his own way, he is very much so, but he's gotten rid of potential, you know, opposing power centers.
Right.
The military has taken loads of loyalty to him. He's gotten rid of a lot of military officers who might have had a more independent view. Obviously, he's completely co-opted an already controlled, state-controlled press, but one that now is basically a Xi Jinping press. He shut down oppositional civil society. So could he turn what civil society there is around into basically just supporting his positions? Yeah, I think all of that's possible. Mm-hmm. But it's an interesting question, because it's really much more about, has he, you know, sort of permanently changed the way that China's governed, away from the collective leadership model that was installed after the chaos of the Mao Zedong era, and returned it to a much less bloody but no less centralized one man type of rule. Mm-hmm. I don't think he's there yet. And in fact, what you've seen over the past few months has been reports of a lot of growing opposition. I don't think it's opposition that's really mm-hmm. ultimately going to amount to much, but it is there and it is leaking out. Mm-hmm. Widely shared online essays about the dangers of the path that China's on. Sort of quasi-apologies by him for certain policies that he's taken, even some media questioning of things that he's done or that China's done. So there is at least the glimmer that elements in society are potentially able to voice not only opposition, but, you know, or dissatisfaction, but opposition. But, you know, the degree to which that just might be blowing off steam and he can shut it down tomorrow again, you know, he's been moving steadily in one direction. We'll have to see how far that goes.
The USS Wasp, an American naval vessel, wanted to make a port call in Hong Kong this week. It was denied.
Yeah.
A foreign ministry spokesman in Beijing was asked about it, and he came up with a wonderfully opaque phrase. He said that these things are reviewed on a case-by-case basis, and they look at it with, quote, the principle of sovereignty and the detailed situation. What is the principle of sovereignty, Michael?
Yeah, it just means that they're angry at the U.S. over the trade war.
It means we decide this as the situation suits us.
Yeah, I mean, and they've done it before. They did it in 2016. They did it in 20. In fact, they did it. There was a bad case. I forget. It was about 2007, 2008, there were two U.S. ships caught in a typhoon that requested safe anchorage in, I think it was Hong Kong. It was certainly somewhere in China, and the Chinese denied them. Mm-hmm. And our two Navy ships had to ride out a typhoon because the Chinese wouldn't let them dock. So this happens over and over. They also canceled the visit of the Navy's top admiral to the United States. He was supposed to meet with our chief of naval operations.
So that is the question. As the two countries go back and forth on tariffs, and we throw things at them and they throw things at us, what else can China do toward us to express its displeasure besides canceling meetings and snubbing warships and so forth?
Well, it does things like that. It tries to find new tariffs that it can put on. More than tariffs, it can just make life miserable for American companies in China. More regulations, slow-walking, licensing agreements, all sorts of things, which they're already doing. So they're going to continue. They're going to continue with that. There's darker things they can do. There's cyber stuff that they could decide. You know, let's unleash the cyber dogs again and let them root around and cause problems in the U.S. And they're sure they're probably doing that. There's no real evidence, at least that I've seen. I guess some dispute this, but that China in any way really significantly limited its cyber espionage, its cyber attacks on the U.S. after Xi Jinping promised Barack Obama he would. We know that they're still going on, or at least going on by proxy. So, there's lots of things that they can do to make their displeasure known. But and here's at least what Trump advocates would say.
Right.
They have to be careful because for the first time they got a guy in office and they don't know what his response is going to be. The Chinese believed in this madman theory. You know, maybe Kim Jong-un did too, and that's a separate discussion about North Korea. But the Chinese were worried. You know, they gave Trump the A1 treatment on his visit, in part because they wanted to, try to appeal to his ego and tell him how special and important he was and Xi Jinping, and they had a great relationship because they were worried about what's he going to do because he swings back and forth. Now, as a tactic, that's not all terrible, to keep them off guard and uncertain. There's a lot of different things they can do and threats, and they've been making threats. They've demanded that we don't do this, they demanded that we get rid of the tariffs, so on and so forth. But they don't know what Trump's response will be. And so they find themselves somewhat at a loss. Now, Trump has done enough on the tariffs, the $200 billion or so in tariffs, that I think they take him seriously. You know, part of the criticism of Trump is that it was all bluff.
Right.
You know, he would roar, but he wouldn't actually bite. And he seems to be biting now. And the Chinese are not used to being bitten.
Right. Well, Trump is not Charlie Sheen, but he probably lives by the same hashtag winning as Charlie Sheen did. Is he winning the tariff issue right now, Michael? And this is a final question. Where are we going with this? If you and I are sitting here a couple months from now, are we still engaged in tariff tit for tat, or do you actually see the two sides sitting down and talking this out?
Well, you know, if you look at the overall size of the economies, the tariff war is almost irrelevant. It's a statistical error. You know, $200 billion on us, $60 billion on a $19 trillion economy?
Right.
It means nothing. China's economy, let's give it the benefit of the doubt and say it's about $8 trillion. Mm-hmm. $200 billion is not a lot.
Right. Now, there is political hardship within the tariff issues. For example, it affects farmers. It affects certain economies and states that are for Trump. And it's a complicated issue for Trump to talk about.
No question.
But you're right. Otherwise, though, it's not crippling the economy. If you look at the stock market, you look at U.S. growth, things are still humming.
Yeah, the pain that is being visited on farmers or American manufacturers who use Chinese steel or Chinese products, that's real, and that's an issue. And I wish the administration would figure out ways to mitigate the pain on them and find other suppliers, and there should be in this, in the world.
So
but
does somebody cry uncle, or do the two sides just kind of whisper uncle to each other?
No, I think I think the Chinese will whisper uncle to the U.S., and it'll have to be done in a way that saves face for them.
Right.
But Trump gets what he wants. I guess the question, though, is, fine, now you take the tariffs off, then what? Are you back to the normal? I mean, what is it that the Chinese ultimately give? Is it these voluntary caps we talked about? Is it other things that the Chinese may give? Obviously, there will have to be something. I don't think that at the end of the day, this is this is not Holly Smoot. This is not 1930s yet. I guess it could become that. Are our economies so much larger and more diversified that you can spread the pain around? Probably.
Right.
You know, this the ultimate question of is, does it get so bad that somebody either threatens war or they're teetering on the brink of economic collapse? I don't think we're there. Right. And the Chinese, if you look at the dynamic, it's a constant dynamic of threatening the U.S. and saying we'll never knuckle under, and then making accommodating overtures such as, you know, okay, we'll send another trade delegation. They canceled one last week, but they'd done that before and they sent them back, and other potential options that might solve this.
It sounds like a lot of diplomacy on very high levels. And diplomacy, I wonder if this president can pull off, because you are talking about winners and losers, Michael, but not declaring somebody a loser. So you have to sort of graciously agree to come together and solve this without turning around and saying, ha, 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 I won, you lost.
That's a good point. Yeah. And I think, you know, that's a different level of discussion from the policy that we've been talking about.
Right.
You know, both sides are engaging in that. You know, both sides are clearly the Chinese are talking about, you know, Trump is a menace to the world, a menace to the global system and the international system. And Chinese are right. They don't want to see that system go away, because it's benefited them. You know, what they don't want to do is make the adjustments that would make it more palatable here. And on that, this is very much a bipartisan issue that people on both sides know that the trade imbalance and Chinese unfair trade practices are simply no longer sustainable. You've got to do something about it. You know, whether they have a full plan, I don't know. Or whether they're going to be successful, that's completely beside the point. But again, I think the political dynamic that's important is that for the first time, the Chinese are probably taking us seriously about this, just as the Japanese finally did in the late 80s and early 90s.
Michael Oslin, enjoyed the conversation.
Thank you. Anytime, Bill.
You've been listening to Area 45, a Hoover Institution podcast on the policy avenues available to the 45th President of the United States. And for this podcast, his policy avenues available toward China. If you've been enjoying Area 45, please don't forget to rate, review, and subscribe to us on iTunes. And if you wouldn't mind, please spread the word, get your friends to have a listen. The Hoover Institution is online at www.hoover.org. And while you're there, sign up for the Hoover Daily Report, which delivers the best work of Michael Oslin and Hoover's fellowship to your inbox weekdays. The Hoover Institution has Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter feeds. Our Twitter handle is @HooverInst. That's @HooverInst. Michael Oslin is on Twitter. His Twitter handle is @MichaelOslin. That is MichaelAuslin, @MichaelOslin. You'll know you found it when you see the words, the old Northwesterner. See? Chicago, you can't get rid of it.
You're
in California. You're being sucked in, right? To tell you, the siren is luring you in.
I'm willing to be lured, believe me.
For the Hoover Institution, this is Bill Whalen. We'll be back soon with another installment of Area 45. Until then, take care. Thanks for listening.
For more podcasts from the Hoover Institution, please visit hoover.org or Hoover's channels on all major podcast platforms, including Apple, Google, Podbean, Stitcher, SoundCloud, and Spotify. I'm Chris Dower for the Hoover Institution. Thanks for listening.